to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Welcome to Full Power Living, where we're helping the world to realize and work with the importance, power, and mastery of human emotions. We welcome your questions and comments. We have chats on blogtalkradio.com/FPL for Full Power Living. And we also have a radio show page at emotionalpro.com. You can call now toll-free also to talk to our guest, 888-498-0570. That's 888-498-0570. Well, when I began my 20 years of being a single mother in 1970, I created a new way of parenting that I started calling conscious parenting and have since taught all over the world. I realized that things were changing so fast there was no way I could anticipate all the challenges my children would be facing, so I couldn't teach them how to handle specific situations. Instead, I needed to equip them with something inside of themselves on which they could draw, so they could make great decisions even when I wasn't around. And it worked quite well. But I had no idea all that would be lying ahead, especially by the time we got to my grandchildren. They are part of our world's first digital natives, children who have no experience of the world before technology. How do we equip them for life, or to navigate a totally connected life available to them today? ScreenWise author Devorah Heitner, PhD, is my guest today talking with me about raising digital natives. Well, she's the founder and director of Raising Digital Natives, a resource for parents and schools who want advice on how to help children thrive in a world of digital connectedness. She serves as a professional development resource for schools wishing to cultivate a culture of responsible digital citizenship. She's a speaker, workshop leader, and consultant, and she's author of Connecting Wisely in the Digital Age, which is a curriculum that's widely used in the U.S. that helps students navigate the common social and emotional challenges of the digital age. And today we're discussing ideas from her latest book, ScreenWise. ScreenWise. W-I-S-E. You can find her on the web at RaisingDigitalNatives.com. Devorah Heitner, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here.
So the issue that I mentioned in my opening comments is really relevant to the situation where children are plugged in, they're conversant with modern technology, and parents may not know what they're doing or even know very much about the technology itself. And just as was happening in the 70s, but with different items involved, the digital world is constantly changing, and that brings a lot of angst to parents. So can you set the stage for us what kinds of angst that's bringing out?
Well, a lot of parents are stressed that they can tell their children are using either apps that are unfamiliar or playing games that are unfamiliar, or coming into new kinds of relationships that are unfamiliar, like even being able to quantify the number of friends that you have is a very different experience. For example, growing up many times or having a digital footprint and experiencing that is very different than the way most of us grew up, right? We didn't have as public a presence. As children, we were only known to our immediate family or the people in our neighborhood or the people in our religious community. We weren't known in this wider public way, and now parents are sharing pictures of their kids, and their children are kind of known beyond, you know, your colleagues who may have never met your kid might have still seen their picture on your social media, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in some new territory, and anytime we're in new territory and communication media changes, we get nervous. As a media historian, that's what I can tell you, looking back over time, anytime you know, a new technology transforms our ability to connect with one another or transforms our relationship with time and space, we're going to get nervous because it's so different than what we experience. But there's a lot of ways that we can guide our children. And so one of the things I always like to tell parents is the kids may have tech savvy, but you have wisdom. So you have the wisdom of lived experience that you've been through some of the experiences your kid is going through. They're just having them mediated in a different way. You've experienced conflict with a close friend and navigated that, and the friendship has grown and not ended. You've experienced feeling envious. You've experienced feeling left out. So these are some of the experiences our kids may be having. They may be in a new arena, but they're not new experiences, and we can help them go through and be resilient and survive these experiences, and also help them learn to be the best friends, the best people, the best children they can be in that space.
I remember talking with a couple one time where I think a medium had said that the child that was about to be born was had the potential for genius, and the father was very freaked out about that. How are we going to raise a child like that? And the mother just said, well, we're going to love it. We're going to treat it like a normal child, and then we'll teach it as much as we know, and then we'll just stand back. And that sounds a lot like this right now.
Absolutely.
So one of the first things that parents do when they realize that their child is, my understanding is this particularly starts happening maybe around second, third, fourth grade. I know my second grade granddaughter last year was absolutely addicted to Minecraft. And what do parents do? They, I believe you said they had three different things. There's the laissez-faire, there's the mentoring, and there are the people who clamp down. And why do we not want to clamp down?
Well, I think the limiters, which is, you know, the group that Alexandra's research identified, the clamper downers, there's sort of an end to how well that can work, right? I mean, it's not that even if we're taking a more mentoring approach that we don't want to limit. I mean, we want our second grader to go to bed at night, and if she wants to play Minecraft all night, we have to insist, no, you're going to sleep. So I don't think anyone is suggesting that some limitations are not a thoughtful and helpful and mentoring approach. It's just that can't be the end. If you're only saying you can only play for an hour a day, but not looking at what's the quality of that experience, who are you playing with? Why do you like it so much? What other experiences can we help you find that are kind of like Minecraft? You know, is it the collaboration that you like? Is it the adventure that you're excited about? Are there other things you could be doing in addition to Minecraft? Not instead, because I think Minecraft can be great, but you know, what else could you be doing that maybe you're interested in architecture and you're building all these really cool things in Minecraft? Well, maybe we can go travel with you, you know, downtown and go look at some buildings and talk about how they're made. So rather than look at child's interest as something to be avoided or something to be critical of, we can look and say, wow, you're a curious 7-year-old. Let's see what's drawing you to this so that I can help you expand your world through this. And if I can play with you some of the time, that's another great way for me to enter into your world. And it doesn't mean that you have to play, you know, hour for hour. You may not have the same kind of time your second grader has to play Minecraft, and you probably don't. Most adults don't. But you may want to play with her at least once a week so that you can kind of understand how she's growing in the game and developing in the game.
Right. And just as a point of interest, she's 8 now. And she recognized herself that she was addicted. Her parents offered her some new activities. She's learning to do some fencing. And also, she's now as involved in cooking for the family as she ever was with Minecraft. So she has moved through it also.
That's great. And again, these are the kinds of interests we do want to encourage, and Minecraft can be great, but, you know, cooking is also great, and the cooking has a tangible benefit for the family, and you may have a kid who really loves watching cooking shows on YouTube, and if I had that kid, I would definitely be encouraging them to do some actual cooking. So take some of these on-screen interests and see how they can translate into some family time, some connected time, and, you know, also some practical skills. Your child is going to one day live on their own. It would be great if not only can they watch a YouTube show, but actually make themselves dinner.
I don't know if you've followed the America's Got Talent show, but this at the last session, a 12-year-old named Grace VanderWaal won $1 million as the winner of this current season. And when she was interviewed, she said that her musical interest in earnest started about a year ago when she went on to YouTube and learned how to play the ukulele.
I love it. I mean, I think that's a really great example, and I hadn't heard that story. I think that's a really great example of the ways that, frankly, you know, the internet is democratizing. I mean, not that everyone has perfect access, but that's not totally even, but many kids do have access to the internet, even kids who don't necessarily have a lot of money. And for example, not every kid gets taken to the symphony as a child or gets taken to see any kind of live music, even, you know, something really, you know, kind of what might seem modest to some of us. Like, many kids don't have access to seeing live music perform. And so seeing someone playing the ukulele on YouTube sparking your interest is a really beautiful example of what an incredible thing that was for her, and it brought her into something that may be a lifelong interest. And of course, it's nice to win lots of money on TV and have that happen, but it's also music, you know, speaks to all of us, and it's something that once you have access to that, you know, it can be a great refuge for the rest of your life.
Yes, yes. And so we get into this issue where we could monitor, but like you say, there's an end to its effectiveness, or we could mentor our children. And you also say that children actually want to be mentored by us. So when you're talking about mentoring, what would that look like to a parent? You want to present mentoring. What is it? What do you do?
Well, kids need to know, for example, when they're in a jam, in an emotional situation with another human being, you know, in a conflict or in a situation where they feel hurt, for example, they don't know how to deal with those situations. They don't always have experience. We're doing a lot of kind of hands-on guiding our kids' social lives in some ways, but then we're not always setting them up with the skills to deal with these things. And kids do need help. And so they run into these situations in their online lives as well, and often they don't know how to deal with it. You know, what do you do if someone, for example, a friend of yours quits when they're losing a game and they get really angry? Or maybe that's you. Maybe losing is really hard for you and you tend to kind of walk away from the game before, you know, it sort of comes to that conclusion, but then your friends don't want to play with you anymore. And how do you kind of look at that? So this is where parents can really be helpful. And it may not be telling kids what to do, but the co-creating solutions with them. Like, okay, next time you're playing the game, what's something you can do if you're starting to feel really angry and you know you might quit or say mean words to your friends? What's something you can do? Can you take a breath? Can you walk away? Can you pause the game and say, hey, I need to take a break. Let's play something else. You know, how can you start to self-regulate? If you know you're playing Minecraft too much and it's interfering with your homework or your sleep, what can you do to maybe, what's the plan? And your kid might suggest, oh, maybe I can only play on weekends. Or maybe I should only play at these times. I mean, your kid may have ideas herself or himself that are actually really good ideas, and they're going to be more likely to adhere to those ideas and pursue those ideas if they're co-created, as opposed to just coming from you, like, okay, well, I don't like that you didn't do your homework on Monday night, so I'm going to say you can only play on weekends. And I'm not suggesting there's never a point, by the way, to be authoritative as a parent. There are times where we absolutely, you know, our kid may say, well, I think my kid should be 11, and you can say, well, no, that's not an appropriate bedtime for you. That's not enough sleep. I know better. Let's, you know, try to be realistic. But there are other times where your child actually may have really good solutions that may alleviate their anxiety. Like, for example, if they're feeling anxious that their friends want to text them all the time and they feel like, oh, I'm a bad friend if I don't text my friend back, you know, late at night, for example. One thing you can say is, well, what's a limit you can place with your friend? How can you, in a friendly way, communicate to your friend, look, I can't text after 9. Is there a nice way that you could say that? And you could try some ideas with them and then let them come up with, this is what I'm going to say to my friend.
Right. Well, we know in business that when a change, so let's say there's a corporation and there needs to be a change made in the corporation, when you try it top down, there you meet a lot of resistance. Whereas if you get the people who are working in the corporation to buy into the idea, and so it goes more bottom up, you have far less resistance. It seems to me that same principle operates here. If you can talk to the child and get the child to suggest things, they're more likely to cooperate, wouldn't you say?
I agree, absolutely. And so that's why we want to do it. And it's also really good for kids to get practice with self-regulation, because that is the rest of your life. So if you spend your time tracking your child, and I have had parents admit to me that they're still geo-tracking their kids on their smartphones in college to see if they're going to class, it's very concerning. Like, at what point, I mean, someday you're not going to be here anymore. So by the time you have kids in college, you should already be thinking, like, there's going to be a world that your kid's going to be in that you're not going to be in, right? So let's think for a minute. If you're tracking your kid to make sure they do what they should, are you going to track them to make sure they go to work one day? What about when they have their own kids? Will you track them to make sure they pick those kids up at childcare? Like, when are you expecting that self-regulation and self-responsibility to kick in? It's concerning to me that parents are doing this. So we need to also not use technology as a tether on our kids and instead, you know, give them some practice. Now, that said, I wouldn't let a 12-year-old completely self-regulate around a smartphone, but sometime between 12 and 18, that still needs to come in.
Mm-hmm. You might be interested. We interviewed Hannah Moreno, who's a Psychology Today editor, and she wrote a book called A Nation of Wimps and originated the concept of the longest umbilical cord in the world, and that was the cell phone.
Sure, and I taught college for 7 years, and I did see my students calling their parents quite a bit, and that is a very big change. And I understand, I mean, a lot of parents now really prize their relationship with their young adults scene and their young adult child, and I think that's very beautiful, but it just because you want to be in touch, you don't want them calling you to help you decide, for example, what classes to take or that kind of thing.
Yes, I certainly agree with you, and that's a big part of your point, which really fits with the parenting that I developed way back when, which is that what you're really trying to do is help your child get set up so that they can run their own life. And so as much as possible, if they can co-create that life, if they can learn as they go along, if they can experiment and you can help them pick up the pieces when they're young, they will do better as they get older.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with that. Absolutely.
Yeah. So now, technology impacts them, according to what you've written in ScreenWise, impacts kids in three really important areas, especially relationships, reputation, and time management.
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned earlier, kids are having relationships with their peers, but now they're relating through the digital media, more so sometimes than face-to-face, but they're still learning about relationships.
Absolutely, and sometimes when you're sitting in front of a screen, the other person is a bit more abstract. It's hard to keep track of, well, I need to have empathy for this person. So one of the things I like to remind families as well is empathy is the app. When I'm thinking about posting a picture, instead of having an app to ask me, is this a good idea? How will people feel who were in the picture? How will people feel who might be not in the picture? Is there a reason I'm sharing it with this particular audience, or could it be shared with a much smaller audience? Empathy has to be with us all the time. We have to be thinking about the recipients. Even if I'm going to send a text to someone late at night, is that going to stress them out? Is it going to wake them up? Would it be better if I hold on to this? Am I texting it to get it off my chest, but really it would actually be better if I communicate this in person the next time I see the person? In other words, am I really doing this for the right reasons? Am I communicating for the right reasons and with good intent? And that's going to always be as adults checking in about, and then we want our children to be checking in as well. And then they need to know in their relationships when they need to go to a friend to repair. So if they're texting with a friend and things get a little haywire or a misunderstanding arises, they may need to know, look, we need to talk in person. And it's fine to text a friend and say, hey, I think we're having a misunderstanding here. Let's talk at school, or let's talk when I see you because I want to understand what's going on. And that's a great way to diffuse the situation. You want to stop texting when you're upset and ideally move to a face-to-face.
Well, that's great advice. We did do a program with a professor up at the University of Washington who was helping students to overcome some of the difficulties that had arisen with them not getting this kind of mentoring. And at one point he mentioned that students were preferring to text people who lived in the room right next to them rather than go talk because they no longer seemed to have the ability to talk directly, or the confidence to talk directly with people.
Yeah, I think the kids get real nervous. They also have a lot of phone anxiety, and they don't like to call someone up on the phone. So that's something I would have kids practice at a certain point. It's actually really worth learning to talk on the phone because it is actually a business skill and a life skill, and you do need to be able to call people on the phone still.
Right.
Still to stay.
Yes, yes. So we're up to our first break, Devorah. Devorah Heitner is my guest today, and we're talking about raising digital natives, becoming screen wise, which is the name of her book, as a parent and in our families. And Devorah, when we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about your suggestion that we get curious about our children and their technology.
Sounds
all right?
Great.
All right. So you're listening to Full Power Living.
As a parent, have you found all the parenting information you've been hearing lately a bit confusing? Are you having trouble sorting out the best response to your defiant child, or feeling hopeless about regaining respect from your teen, or determining whether your actions as a parent are the right ones? Instead of the usual pressures of parenting that you've been experiencing, you can partner with your child, raising incredible kids who are destined to become amazing adults. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, giving you the opportunity to become the incredible parent for incredible kids. We have the method and the tools. You bring your optimism for learning and the kids. Raise Incredible Kids offers a comprehensive system for raising kids who are responsible, make their own great decisions, and become immune to peer pressure. To get you ready for this new era in parenting, get my free 10-page report, Incredible Communication That Helps You Create Incredible Kids, by visiting RaiseIncredibleKids.com now. That's RaiseIncredibleKids.com.
Welcome back to Full Power Living. I want to urge you to call in now to talk with Devorah Heitner, who's a consultant for schools, parents, and teachers and children on being screen-wise in this time of constant connectivity with others and the world through technology. She's also a media historian, which interests me. Our toll-free number is 888-498-0570. Right now, I have a couple of announcements. Next week on Full Power Living, I'm talking with Luke Adler, who's author of Born to Heal, Heal Yourself, Heal the World, in which he guides readers to develop a wellspring of love within themselves. Adler believes that all beings on the planet want to heal, and that the desire to restore health is deep and persistent, even when it is suppressed by life traumas. He says, with a wellspring of love inside, we all become healers. That's next Thursday, September 29th at 9 a.m. Pacific time. In the meantime, go to our homepage on emotionalpro.com and click subscribe, and we'll put you on the list so you get notifications of our upcoming events. And thank you for telling your friends and family to listen also. Today, I'm talking with workshop leader, consultant, and author Devorah Heitner regarding mentoring children who are digital natives to keep themselves conscious, safe, and making great decisions as they grow up and learn to navigate the digital world at the same time that they're growing up. And so, Devorah, before our break, I noticed by reading your book that you suggest the Buddhist approach for mentoring, that parents get curious about what technology means to their children, the benefits they're seeking. You've mentioned some of this already. And also getting curious about their children's personal experiences with technology. And that increases our empathy and allows us to help our children become more resilient. Will you expand on that a bit?
Absolutely. We really want to be curious about what it's like to grow up in these times, because first, it will absolutely increase our empathy. When we think about what it's like for our children to grow up being photographed all the time, what it's like, many of us are walking around with our smartphones, and I would include myself and my husband in this, with more pictures of our child than might exist of our entire childhood just on our phones. What's it like for kids to be photographed so frequently, and what does that feel like? How does that affect their experience of their appearance? Is that stressful? Is that fun? Is it just something they take for granted? We want to be curious about that. We want to be curious about what it's like to be able to get access to so much information. Our kids can Google so many things, and it may be that they get information that's, you know, way beyond their reading level or their developmental stage, but they can get it. And so what's it like? You know, you hear something in the family, maybe a grandparent has a diagnosis or someone makes a reference to something that's going on in the news, and you could instantly find out more, whereas our parents used to be able to kind of shut us down sometimes, like, oh, well, that's not for kids. Like, you'd ask, well, tell me more about XYZ that you just mentioned. And you would have had to be a very intrepid kid, go to the library and really do quite a lot of research to get more, and most of us would probably have just given up and said, okay, I guess I'm going to have to eavesdrop more to find out about that, or I won't find out about that right now. Our kids can get this information, you know, whether it's, again, about world events, you know, something going on in our immediate family that we might be talking about in whispered tones, and they're going to be able to look it up, and they may find things that are completely inappropriate for them. They may find things that are way beyond what we would have told them if we'd been more open with them. So thinking about those experiences, then we want to help them navigate by being curious, asking them what it feels like, asking them what they've done. You know, what, when I ask a room full of third graders if they've seen sites that aren't for kids, they all say yes. So then, well, then what do you do? Because it, as a parent, our instinct is to panic, and our instinct is to be mad at our kids, like, why have you done this wrong thing? Why have you trespassed into a bad part of the internet, or why were you looking that up in the first place? But instead, you want to say, okay, well, what did it feel like when you saw that, and what's your plan for the next time that's going to happen? And that's when you want to leap in and also maybe co-create some solutions. I'm not suggesting we stay at the curiosity stage and we never help kids pass there, but we have to start by being curious, because we shouldn't assume, we shouldn't imply our adult interpretations of the world to their experience. We may be stressed out by being photographed all the time. It may be neutral for kids. They may have a totally different interpretation of a website that they saw than we do. It doesn't mean that it's good for them, but for example, you know, children may see something that is very adult or pornographic and really problematic for them, but that doesn't mean they understood what they saw it with our adult lens. And so we need to be careful before we put our adult interpretations onto all of their experiences. The way they use social media is very different. Even the way they game, if we play a game, we're going to approach it very differently. I would start out saying, well, what are the rules? You know, kids will start out much more experientially. They just start playing the game, and then they figure it out. So by trying things the way they try them, we're going to have a different ability to help them navigate those things. Whereas if we use our adult lens to constantly interpret their experience through our experience, I think we're missing a lot of what's happening for kids, and we're missing a lot of opportunities to help kids experience what they're actually experiencing versus what we think they are experiencing.
Well, and that's building our own empathy too. You say something very, very easily. You obviously do it all the time, but I'd like to emphasize it just a moment because I think it's very important. And my experience after 44 years of being a family therapist is that not a lot of families have the focus that you have. What you say periodically is, what are you going to do next time? How would you like to do this next time? And looking to the future, and especially if your child is making a mistake of some kind or has made a mistake, you can't change what has happened, but you can help them move into next time. And I really appreciate that you're bringing that into this whole topic of, you know, look forward. What can you learn? What can you do differently next time? So thank you for that.
Thank you. And I think, I mean, it's interesting to frame it as a Buddhist approach. And I think there's many different traditions that would think about it in this way. I think the curiosity definitely does come from some of my meditation experience. But then also, you know, from my Jewish perspective, the whole idea of teshuva, which is redemption, is like also not just repentance, but coming back to the same situation and not making the same mistake. So, you know, we're all about forgiveness. We're all about, you know, being able to repent. So it's not nobody's saying we can prevent mistakes. We're human, so we're all making mistakes constantly. But how can I come back to that situation, whether it's me and my spouse, where I was, you know, impatient with him in a situation and I want to come back to that situation and do better? How can my child, you know, just yesterday my child got in trouble for school for using words in a way that he shouldn't have. He said something that was too strong. He got very angry and he said something that was too strong to a classmate. And what I said to him is, let's think about some other things you can say that still assert the same boundary, but you won't get in trouble. right? Mm-hmm. Because that's going to be a trigger word and the other kids can get really upset. But what can you say that still asserts the boundary, that still says, I need you to stop what you're doing because it's bothering me, but won't get you in trouble? And we practice. And, you know, he still may make mistakes. It's not like we make a plan and it always works, but you have to have the plan, and the plan makes it more likely to work. And the more you practice the plan and try, the better it gets.
Right.
All of us under stress make mistakes. All of us are going to text impatiently or email impatiently or, you know, share something on social media that maybe we shouldn't. And then it's always about, well, how can we get it right next time? And then I think we also need to work on allowing other people to repair, so that we like to really heap on the judgment when other people make mistakes, especially in the digital realm. You know, I can't believe he tweeted that. And then we, you know, 50,000 people try to shame the person who wrote the bad tweet. And, you know, I'm certainly more forgiving of some things than others myself, but I think we have to watch that tendency as well and give people a chance. If someone really genuinely apologizes, and especially when someone's a child, you know, we really need to give them a chance to come back into the community and say, okay, yeah, you made that joke on the group text, and yeah, everyone was kind of offended. It wasn't that funny. You thought it was funny, but it wasn't. But let's try to go forward from here. We can't say to an 11-year-old, okay, you can't be in the community anymore because you tried this joke and it wasn't funny. We got to give that kid more chances. And I
right.
think the digital world makes it so easy to frame up someone's mistake and kind of reiterate it, the same mistake, but we can keep looking at it, and we need to find a way to move on.
Well, yes, and I don't remember the exact term you used, but I had an experience once. I had a person that was living in Hong Kong came to the area where I work, and I had worked with her before as a therapist, and she came for a couple of sessions, and we got a lot of work done, and we agreed that we would communicate, and I was talking to her with the same voice in me that I had talked with her in person, but after a couple of exchanges, she said, "On email, you sound so much colder than when I'm in person. There's something missing in technological communication that can only be given when a person can see your face or hear the tone of your voice, right?"
I think that that's true, and many of us struggle with that, and that's why there are times where we do need to go to the other person and say, you know, hey, can we talk in person, or email or text them and say, hey, can we talk in person, or at the very least, can we do a video chat, which is still not, I think, the same as in person, but it certainly gives you some more tools to work with, some more data, facial expressions, et cetera. Because mm-hmm. it's very easy, and even sometimes we think that email and text are so convenient, but I've had 90 emails cover something that a 5-minute phone call could have solved, you know, and so there are times where it's not actually convenient.
Right.
But it seems like that because we're time separated, but in fact, it's not.
So, Devorah, the work you do didn't exist 25 years ago. In the 70s and 80s, when I was raising my children, computers were just happening. And now a child as young as 5 can have their own smartphone. And so I'm curious, what drew you to this topic so that you became an expert and a consultant on helping children and businesses and parents with the issues that come up when we have constant connectivity and we leave digital footprints and we don't always know who's going to hear or see our message?
It was kind of a great story. I mean, I was a professor until 2012 of media history, and I loved teaching my kids media classes. I taught a lot of different classes on a lot of different things, but I took my kids media students out into the community. We would go to American Girl and do an ethnography of how families make purchasing decisions. I had my students analyzing kids' television commercials. It was a really great class that I taught pretty much every year as a college professor for the 7 years that I taught. And in that time, I also became a parent and got really curious about these issues. And I started to hear from friends who were educators that digital citizenship was an issue in the classroom. And I heard from parents that they were struggling with, you know, very conflicting messages about screen time and what kids should do with devices. And I also saw my friends kind of try to figure out what was appropriate to share about their kids on social media as parents. So all these things kind of fed into my decision to leave higher ed and start raising digital natives, just realizing that this was something that I loved doing, because I started doing some talks on this topic while I was still a professor. And then I also realized I was better suited to be an independent entrepreneur than to be in higher ed. And then it was better suited to my life as a parent, although I think I may have underestimated the amount of power.
Oh, yes, I know about that.
I had, you know, a little bit of a dream there on work-life balance that I'm still trying to achieve, but, you know, 7 to 10 years later. but
right.
I love it, and I still love higher ed, and I still sometimes teach here and there, do work in the higher ed world, and would love to collaborate with people in those worlds, you know, to continue to do research, because as an institutionalized person, you have more access to doing research. A lot of my research now is based on the work I do with schools and focus groups with parents I do through schools. So it's not as big. You know, I don't have the institutional resources to do a 10,000 parent survey. So I'm also working with other people's resources and research as I, you know, I cite in the book some of my own research, but then other people's. But I do feel like my media historian hat is always on, you know, that I am coming from my doctoral training and my life as a parent and my life as a parent of a kid in school and my own interactions. Like I wrote a blog post about, you know, etiquette for emailing your child's teacher in the digital age, because I found myself wondering, gosh, am I emailing the teacher too much? Is it, you know, when should I call? When should I email? When should I leave it alone? Or try to, you know, find out another way. And those are honestly, parents are struggling with those questions all over. So I think all of those experiences, you know, both my work with the schools, my life as a parent, and my history, you know, with doing my own graduate study and teaching college, all affect my work as raising digital natives and all sort of feed in any given day. And it's really a lot of fun to do this. I definitely love doing raising digital natives, and I love getting to collaborate. I've gotten to work with other, you know, centers and other places where they do this kind of work, and it's really lovely. There's a digital citizenship summit coming up in October, and I'll get to see a lot of my colleagues who are in this conversation with me, and that's really exciting too.
Wow, that's really a great story. I really like that. And I just let me comment that you also, not only are you a media historian, you are making history by doing the work that you're doing, because I don't know, are there very many people doing what you're doing? I don't think so.
It's a relatively small group of us. I mean, I think there are definitely some other great people doing this work, and I cite some of them in the book, and I get to hang out with some of them at the conferences. But I would say, given the magnitude of the challenge and the magnitude of the disconnect between kids and adults on digital citizenship, and even the way adults are quite confused among ourselves about what appropriate digital etiquette and citizenship are, I think there could be probably more people doing this work. And I'm grateful to have the colleagues that I do. I think we're all very eager to see schools get better at this. I think one of the disconnects we're all seeing is that schools think parents need to be doing a lot more to supervise kids at home on social media, games, et cetera. And then parents think schools need to be doing more to educate kids how to do these things appropriately. And so there's this huge disconnect where everyone thinks someone else should be doing more to help kids with this. And meanwhile, kids are kind of out there with not a lot of mentorship, honestly. And I think parents and schools also have these very, think in these kind of boxes and categories like, oh, well, this is your school device, so of course you're only going to do school things. And kids are living in the cloud. They're going to text their friends from their school device. They're going to do their homework on their personal device. They don't see any lines that we see. So even the boxes, again, this is where we have to get curious about what it's like to be them. They don't see tech, you know, as, oh, well, this is my school tech, this is my home tech, this is my leisure tech, this is my work, you know, digital time. This is just their world. They're just in it. You know, and we need to kind of jump in with them and see that and understand their experience in a more holistic way.
Well, it seems to me, though, and you bring this up a lot, that parents may want schools to take care of it because they feel like they're not equal to the task. And I liked that in your book you say parents don't have to know everything, that their children can even teach them something. And more to the point, you say that digital literacy is a skill set and it can be learned.
Absolutely. Digital literacy is a skill set and it absolutely can be learned. And that parents don't need to know everything. You don't need to have a PhD in Snapchat to know that if I see a party I'm not invited to as it's happening and if my friends are there, I'm going to feel terrible, right? I don't need to understand everything about Snapchat to know, hey, it can show me social experiences, you know, in real time that I'm not part of. Well, right away, I already know as a human being that's been through various social exclusions, as we all have, who has not experienced some social exclusion in their life, right? We've all not been invited to something, then of course you're going to feel bad seeing that. So I don't need to know everything that Snapchat does. Just tell me that, and I already know that it's an emotional minefield for my kid. That doesn't mean I'm going to forbid it, but it might mean that I want to support it. It might mean that if I see my kid looking at it and getting visibly upset, I might encourage them to take a break from it, right? I might get curious about what's going on potentially. Again, it doesn't mean I have to say we have to outlaw Snapchat because it gives us bad feelings. We want to be aware that that's a part of its potential. It can also give us good feelings. It can do a lot of things. But do you see what I'm saying? I mean, you don't have to know everything that the app does. Now, if your child is spending a lot of time in an app, I do think it's better to know it than not. If your child's a Minecrafter, it's better for you to at least have some clue about what can happen. What are the modes of play? Are they playing on a public server with strangers, or are they only playing personally or with people that you know? So you do want to know enough, and especially with our young kids, you do not really want them spending a ton of time on an app or a game that you have no clue what it does. The flip side is you don't need to know everything about the app to be able to parent effectively around it. Does that make sense? So I'm not saying you want to be in the dark and have no clue, but I am saying, you know, just because you know that Musical.ly is a karaoke app, but you personally don't know everything about how to use it, just think about the kind of lyrics that someone could be doing karaoke to and decide, do you want your first grader using this app? You know, maybe not, right? Is there something else they could be doing? Or just know that it's a social sharing app that adults and kids are on together. Do you want your six-year-old on the app? I think you can make a good decision just with that information. You don't need to know everything.
Right. Well, as I was reading the book, and you address the answers to a lot of these, so I just want to bring them up and maybe we can talk about one or two, that parents have a lot of concerns in common. We've already talked about having control over how much our child is online or how much exposure they get. We have the issue of how to keep our children safe when there are predators who can have easy access online and also can figure out our child's whereabouts. And our children can do dumb things that will haunt them, create a digital footprint that might be out there forever. And as we've already talked, relating in person, not just through technology. And the questions are just endless. And when we, as human beings, when we don't know about something, we become fearful. So I imagine you run into fear quite a bit.
Yeah, and it's understandable that parents feel fear. Their kids can do things that we couldn't do, like create a video of themselves and share it on YouTube for the whole world to see. And it's not crazy to be concerned, but you don't want to just stop at the panic mode. Again, you want to move through the panic to get curious and then see, okay, well, maybe my kid actually does have privacy settings because they're super savvy fifth grader and they figured it out, or maybe they don't and we need to help them with that, or maybe I want them to just do videos for the family only, so maybe they should take the videos just on their device and not socially share them at all. Or, you know, but first of all, you want to get curious, you know, go allow yourself that moment of panic, because I think it is a brave new world and it's a little scary, and then move through it, but also find community with other parents, but try to find the parents who are not stuck in panic mode. Like, you don't want to hang around with other parents and just stoke the fear. But find a parent, maybe, like, there's a parent in my community who used to be a video game designer. If I had a question about a game, guess who I'd call? That guy knows a lot more than I do. And he has three kids who love games. And so he'd be a great person to call if, you know, I mean, I'm not going to bother him every time I want to know about a new game. I have other ways of doing research. But if I have a specific question or something's really, you know, I'm trying to understand something in a deeper way, he'd be someone I would love to have coffee with and talk to you about it. If I just have a very basic question, I can certainly look up the game myself. I can go to Common Sense Media, which is a great resource. I can go to YouTube and actually watch other players play the game before I allow my child to play it. I could watch those videos with my child. I could say, well, let's look at someone else playing the game. Let's look at them together. And then I could say, gosh, I'm feeling a little nervous about the game. What do you think? You know, you know, and that's again, it's a great conversation. Now, I live in the real world. My husband and I work a lot. My son doesn't always get, you know, all the attention he wants in the moment he wants it from us. So I understand that every time your child wants a game, sometimes it's easy to just say yes or no versus doing that research with them. But you can say, you know, let's put that in the parking lot till Saturday, and then we'll sit down and look at these three apps you asked for and decide if one of them might be appropriate. You can say to your kid they have to wait. You may not be available in that moment that they ask to investigate the game with them. And so it's fine for them to understand they may have to wait till you do have time.
You're teaching some very important things about basic parenting with this too. That's really great. So let's take a look at the big issue that people talk about. How do we protect our children from cyberbullying? What's your experience there?
Well, I mean, thankfully, true cyberbullying is a little bit less common than other kinds of difficulties we can run into online with just unkindness or hurt feelings. But if a child is being bullied, if they're, you know, being attacked in a sustained way online, or if someone is threatening them or, you know, harassing them anonymously or openly, we do need to get help. And so school may be a place to start. If school is unresponsive, you can go both to therapists in the community and law enforcement. You also want to disconnect your child from that app. I mean, if your child is being harassed, for example, in an anonymous space, like AskFM or another anonymous app, I would certainly say delete the app, because that app is giving the bully access to your child's heart and their soul. And at this moment, you can say to your kid, this is not your fault. This is not a punishment. I'm not taking away this app because you did anything wrong in the app. Someone is doing something wrong to you, and that app is giving them access to you. So right now we need to take a break from it. It may be that you could have an account on this app someday in the future. You know, we're not saying you can never do this again, but right now we need to stop this person's access to you. Sometimes you may need to change your child's phone number if they're being texted and they don't know who the texts are coming from. I mean, there are some very concrete things, steps you can take as a parent. I will say cyberbullying is a very challenging situation, and it's not always clear who to go to. If school is not helpful, or if it's not a situation that involves school, you may need to involve law enforcement, and that may be really scary, and they may not always know what to do. If you go, you know, to your town police officer, they're not immediately going to have a clue necessarily, depending where you live, on how to handle the situation. So you may need to try a lot of different avenues, but you should really stop at nothing. If your child is truly being harassed, stalked, bullied online, you need to go to as many people as you have to shut it down. And also really at that moment, limiting your child's tech access is limiting that person's access to your child. So again, it needs to be communicated. It's not a punishment for your child, but in that moment, you really need to limit their access so that you can break the cycle of what's happening.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to note, too, that that middle school time where children are so concerned about their image and how they look to other people and whether a single hair is out of place and so forth, my experience is that parents try to stand back and leave their children lots of privacy and so forth. And so one of the hazards, it seems to me, is that a parent may not realize that their child is being bullied. And one of the things that you offer is to, as a parent, as you're working with children, operate as a resource person or a consultant, or encourage your children to make you the bad guy if they need to in order to set a limit.
Absolutely. It's great for kids. And the younger kids are, the more likely they are to do this. And it's one of the few maybe really good things about the super young kids getting online, and especially getting phones, is, you know, a fifth grader is much more likely to say, hey, my mom checks my phone. If you say that, I'm going to get in trouble, or we can't talk mean about other kids here because my mom checks my phone. It's not okay. And eventually you want them to become the eighth grader who just doesn't want a friend who talks mean in mean ways about other kids, or who says, I don't like what you're saying, I'm going to get out of the conversation, or who just quietly gets out of the conversation. You know, not every moment in life is an upstand moment. I've gotten out of conversations without making a point, without telling people I'm leaving. I've just gotten out of conversations because I don't like how it's going. I don't always have the energy or feel like it's worth it. Some people may not, you know, be worth engaging with in a deep way about what their mistakes they're making. I may just want to vamos, you know, and be gone. But the point is, eventually you want your kid to independently make some of those decisions. But yeah, when they're 10 or 11 saying, mom looks at my phone, dad checks my text, I think is a legitimate way for them to get out of a situation where they're uncomfortable. And you should let them know that if somebody, and also let them know that even if they've broken your rules, even if they did get on an app, you said you're waiting till you're 13, they got on the app when they're 12. If someone's harassing them in that app, you are in their corner. You are going to help them deal with the situation. They are not on their own. We really are, these problems are too big for kids to solve on their own. And I always tell kids, look, even if an adult is being harassed online, they will go to someone for help. This is not a situation you can solve by yourself. It doesn't mean you're a little kid. It doesn't mean you're immature. Quite the opposite. You know, it's very mature to ask for help when you need it. So we need to communicate to our kids that it's okay. And even if they've broken our rules, like say our rule is you don't text after 9 and they're texting late at night and then something happens that's uncomfortable for them, they should still come to us And yeah, we're not thrilled that they made a mistake and they texted after 11 or whatever. But the point is, you know, the rule that they broke is not as big a deal as the fact that someone's harassing them and we want to keep them safe.
Mm-hmm. You're reminding me, my husband and I had, it was his daughter and I ended up adopting her because her mother died when she was 12. And she was in theater in high school and came home one day and said, you know, I go to these parties after the play is done and there are lots of kids drinking there. And what would you say if I experimented with alcohol? And so we had a conversation. I mean, it was a great blessing that she did that. We had a conversation and one of the things that we made a point of telling her is no matter what, we don't care what kind of condition you're in, or if you make a mistake, we want you to call us because we want you to be safe. You matter to us more than any mistake that you make. And it turned out that she didn't try it at all for a long time, but that's almost like been practice for what we need to do now with our digital natives. We need to say, no matter what happens, you can come to us and we'll do the best to help you figure it out.
Exactly. And I think we have a lot of parents of kids who've gone through really terrible things who would say, please, you know, be clear about that. And I think it's very, very tough. I think kids really don't know where to turn when some of this stuff happens. And the apps don't always help you. You know, you want to think like, oh, the app will help you if you're being harassed in the app, but that's a hard road to go.
Uh-huh.
As well, it doesn't always work out that way. It doesn't always work out, you know, quickly the way we would want it to. So we have to be really, really thoughtful and be there for our kids. And we need places where they can go and get immediate help if they feel concerned. And like I said, I mean, I think most of the time we're really dealing with more like, I just feel bad because I wasn't in that picture or that text offended me, but it doesn't rise to the level maybe of bullying or harassment. But kids still need tools to deal with those situations. And almost every kid, really every kid is going to experience that. I mean, every kid's going to get a text where they feel offended or left out or something, or play a game where mm-hmm. the other person gets too angry or they get too angry. And so those are the everyday situations that all parents really need to address. And I think what happens is we get over-focused on the more sensational stories about sexting and bullying, and we ignore the sort of day-to-day kind of traumas.
Right.
And those are what our kids need some experience with pretty universally. And then obviously if it does escalate into something more serious, we need to get help.
And another thing that you point out comes up several times is that children are not always looking at the same things that we're looking at. Brings to mind that many years ago, this daughter is close to 30 years old now. So many years ago, she took one of the early selfies and put it up on the web, and she started getting all of these sexually tinged responses from men, and she came to us and saying, this is horrible, why are these people reacting this way? And we looked at the picture, and she had held the camera up over her head and looked into it, and it went right, the view went right down her blouse, right? And she was looking at the face. She never noticed that there was anything else going in that picture besides her face. And so we gently suggested to her that she might want to let us take the picture and she could put that up because, you know, but kids do these things and parents may react that they've done something wrong when really we have to remember that they're very young, they're very unknowledgeable, they're very naive, and they need our help and our love and our support.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Wow. So, you know, what I liked in reading your book, Devorah, is it was a lot like the parenting method that I developed so many years ago. I came to see our Earth as a giant school, and I told my children that we are all here to learn and grow. And therefore, every experience they had was an opportunity to learn something. And I also realized that they needed to learn how to make their own decisions. And I didn't shield them from the consequences, but I did offer them help in how to work things through. They also had to forgive themselves for making mistakes so that they could move on to something else and make new decisions. And I saw that same pattern when you're talking about working with digital natives. And what you're really doing is helping them in their present now and helping them to take what they learn into their future and their lives as adults.
That's the idea. We really need to think about that, you know, that we are raising future adults that we will one day sort of drop off somewhere with a trunk or help them move into their first apartment, and then we're going to be waving out the back window. And so we can't be just kind of on them tracking their every move forever. We need to have a plan for how we're going to help them cultivate that self-reliance and good decision-making.
Wow. Well, I want to, it's time for us to stop. I think you and I, this is a huge topic as I can see. But I want to thank you for being a leader in the world, in this whole new way of being in the world. And I very much appreciate your invitation to parents to raise their own level of consciousness so they can help equip their children to develop their abilities to relate and make good decisions and repair mistakes. I think it's an incredibly important message.
Thank you. I invite you to visit my blog, and I'm always blogging about questions that parents send and other things like that, so at raisingdigitalnatives.com. And hopefully ScreenWise, my new book, will be a good guide for parents as well, especially parents of, I would say, elementary and middle schoolers. It's a good time to start to think about these issues.
Right. So that's raisingdigitalnatives.com. And your workshops are listed there and your blog. Is there anything else that I'm forgetting that people can find there?
If you want to reach out, if you prefer to engage on Twitter, I'm on Twitter at Devorah Heitner. So that's a good kind of fast way if you have questions or want to learn more about the work. And then ScreenWise is available everywhere you can get books, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and also your local independent bookstore.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for covering this whole area, for being common sense about the whole thing and so supportive of parents as well. And finally, thank you for being on Full Power Living today. I've really enjoyed having you.
I appreciate it. It's my honor to talk with you, and it's really fun hearing about how that translates to your conscious parenting practice and the ways that you've been thinking about this work for a long time. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. All right. So next week, we're exploring how to develop a wellspring of love inside of yourself so that you can heal yourself and others. I'll be talking with Luke Adler, author of Born to Heal. I look forward to having you with us on Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific time, as well as your friends and family who might want to listen with you. And you can listen live on archives, or you can subscribe to Full Power Living on iTunes also. So thank you for listening today. I appreciate your presence. Our producer is Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you, pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.